Welcome. You are listening to a recording provided for the use of those who are blind and or print impaired. Materials or items read on Airs LA and the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Welcome to episode 297 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening show developed and designed for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host and producer, and I look forward to sharing with you over the next 40 minutes updates to our local garden scenes and recent articles about gardens, plants, and designers, both in California and around the world. Gardens are in my DNA. I was raised in a family of gardeners, and my grandparents and mother handed down a love of flowers, of orchids, and of roses, among many other gifts. I have been an inveterate gardener for years, from that first six-pack of marigolds I bought at Home Depot in suburban Connecticut to laying out birthday rose garden, planting fruit trees, and rescuing overgrown and underloved gardens, as well as building my own garden library with classic design texts, memoirs, and commentaries from gardeners and designers alike, and, well, just a few glossy coffee table indulgences. I've spent years getting to know California's Mediterranean garden landscapes, plants, and climate, even as I have fallen for English and continental garden design traditions, grown fond of the particularities and peculiarities of succulents, which perform so well in our climate, and learned to love and respect the quiet power of a Japanese garden. I've been active in local garden societies and visited botanical gardens across the country and around the world, believing not only in the benefits of gardening itself, but of being in the garden, and have been charmed by that special alchemy of plants, climate, soil, design, place, and space. Gardens are a place where we can become more alive and more connected with the world we share with others. And, as the good book reminds us, it all began in a garden. Welcome to this week's show. We start this week with an article by Jeanette Marantos, a staff writer of the Los Angeles Times, as part of her plant series. This article was published on June 2nd in the Los Angeles Times. 13 show-stopping California native plants that will bring riotous color to your garden. California native plants tend to be more modest than their hyper-gaudy non-native cousins, more readily available on nursery shelves. Many California native plants also go dormant in the summer, which without careful planting can leave landscapes looking drab in Southern California's hottest months. There are many show-stopping native blooms, however. You just have to know where to look. So here's the truth about California native plant landscapes. Without careful planting, they can get a little drab, especially in the summer when many go dormant, brittle, and brown. In climates where there's ice and snow, we don't fuss so much about dead-looking shrubs because, you know, it's winter, and plants are supposed to die back in the cold. But in sunny Southern California, many of our native plants adapted to hot, dry summers by choosing that time to go dormant, which nowadays makes it hard for them to compete for landscape space when our nursery shelves are brimming with eye-popping non-native plants with flowers so gaudy they look plastic. Yes, native plants are definitely authentic and great for supporting our birds and pollinators, but their magic can be subtle in a landscape, one that takes time to appreciate. It's a little like eliminating added sugars from your diet. It takes a while for your taste buds to adjust to the flavors of unsweetened food, but once done, the artificial stuff, like ultra-processed peanut butter loaded with sugar, for instance, never tastes so delicious. So while your garden palate may need time to adjust, you don't need to give up show-stopping color to have a native plant landscape. It just takes a bit of research, planning, and like most of gardening, patience until the plants start to bloom. Here's a subjective and by no means exhaustive list of 13 native plants with gorgeous flowers. I got suggestions from several experts in the native plants world, including Tim Becker, horticulture director at the Theodore Payne Foundation, Mike Evans, co-owner of the Tree of Life Nursery in San Juan Capistrano, Lucinda McDade, executive director of the California Botanic Garden, the state's largest botanic garden devoted to California native plants, Bob Sussman, owner of Matilla Nursery in Moorpark, and Penny Nyan, manager of Las Palitas Nursery in Santa Margarita, one of the state's oldest native plant nurseries, started by her mother, Celeste Wilson, and her father, Bert Wilson, who developed a couple of showy cultivars listed below before his death in 2014. Although Las Palitas Nursery is located in California's Central Coast, most of its clientele who order their plants online are based in Los Angeles. We also got suggestions from a charming subreddit called r/ceanothus, which I recommend heartily to anyone with an interest in California native plants. If you want more suggestions, and there are many, try chatting with the helpful and knowledgeable people there. The recommendations below are grouped by color and their prime flowering season. Please note, the best time to plant native shrubs and perennials is in the fall, so the plants have time to settle in during our typically cooler and wet winters, one hopes. This list is to help you plan. If you see something you really must have, contact your favorite native plant nursery and put in a request to help ensure it's available this fall when you are ready to plant. Hot season bloomers, yellow, creams, and whites. California goldenrod, Solidago velutina speciality californica, produces tall spikes of deep yellow flowers up to 5 feet tall in the summer and fall. So plant behind lower growing plants to create a colorful backdrop. Prefers to be wet in winter and spring, dry in summer and fall, but can take some summer water. Beloved by birds and pollinators. Desert marigold, also known as wild marigold, Baylea multiradiata, are very cheerful yellow daisy-like flowers on tall stems that bloom profusely spring and summer. These are short-lived perennials that will reseed, and they seem to thrive in dry, nutrient-poor, fast-draining soil where other flowers fade. California buckwheat, Eriogonum fasciculatum, produces clouds of white, pink tinged blossoms starting in late spring into fall that turn a handsome, dramatic rust color at the end of the season. These are nice alone, but also spectacular on a hillside. You can see them along the cliffs in Laguna Beach, for instance, and pollinators like butterflies and native bees will thank you happily with many, many visits. Coulter's Matilla hapapi, Rhamnea coulteri, is also known as the fried eggplant, and it's easy to see why once it starts to bloom, with massive, white, crepe papery flowers around large, yolk-colored centers. While the nickname doesn't exactly sing, it's very apt. The plant blooms into summer, and its flowers are so stunning people will stop to take photos. But be warned, this plant grows big and doesn't play well with others. It tends to crowd other plants out, so plan carefully. If you have the space, it's a very effective planted in masses, especially on slopes, and it's so tall that once it stops blooming, it creates a feathery green wall behind whatever ornamental plants you want to add in front. One of the most effective landscape displays I've ever seen is on the Cal State University Channel Islands campus in Camarillo, where masses are planted against the old stucco buildings on Ventura Street, creating a radiant display of breathtaking blooms bobbing and bouncing in the breeze. And I wasn't the only one stopping to take photos. Reds and oranges. Hollywood Flame Hummingbird Fuchsia, Epilobium Canum Hollywood Flame, is one of the most attractive California fuchsias for landscaping and a profuse bloomer in late summer and fall, with narrow gray-green leaves and tubular red flowers laced with yellow around the tips. Like all California fuchsias, this is a hummingbird magnet. CalScape, the California Native Plant Society's plant database, says there's no better single plant than California fuchsias for attracting hummers. La Palitas Nursery developed and first started selling this showy perennial and keeps planting more, but Nyant says it sells out quickly, so keep trying. another harder-to-find fuchsia that can stand some shade and has more ornamental, deeper green foliage is Wayne's Silver Fuchsia, Epilobium septentrionale Wayne's Silver. One possible source is Matilaha Nursery, but call ahead to make sure it's available for pickup. The nursery doesn't ship. If you can't find either of these popular cultivars, at least add one California fuchsia, Epilobium canum, to your garden since it's guaranteed to provide bright scarlet splashes during SoCal's hottest, driest months. These plants die back in the winter, or you can cut them back. They spread and reemerge in the spring, looking a little weedy and dull at the start. But at the dog days of summer, when your native garden looks like it's given up the ghost, stand back and watch your fuchsias explode with deep red blooms. Desert globe mallow, Sphaerelsia ambigua, blooms most of the year with vibrant deep orange flowers and fuzzy silvery green foliage if it gets a little irrigation in the summer, and you cut it back about a third after its blooms are spent, says Sussman, who usually teaches a native plant's landscaping class in the late fall through Conejo Valley Adult Education in Thousand Oaks. Also known as apricot mallow, this showy shrub has bowl-shaped flowers popular with pollinators, and it's available to white, lavender, and deep reddish-orange blooms. A gorgeous variant, known as Lewis Hamilton Desert Mallow, Sphaerelsia ambigua Lewis Hamilton, is harder to find, mostly because it sells out so quickly. But if you can get one, its deep reddish coral flowers are true showstoppers. Island Pink Yarrow, Acalea millefolium Island Pink, is a native of Santa Cruz Island that blooms in pale pink to deep red bunches, like little bouquets, in spring and summer. Native yarrows also come in white, like the Sonoma Coast yarrow, Acalea millefolium Sonoma Coast, which produces beautiful masses of snowy white flowers that are popular with a host of pollinators, from bats and birds to butterflies and bees. Purples and blues, woolly blue curls, Trichostema lanatum, blooms fall through spring with gorgeous curls of deep lavender blue flowers and narrow, bright green leaves as sweetly fragrant as bubble gum. The trick to keeping this plant alive is to water it regularly when it's first planted, but after a year or so, when the plant is established, stop watering, especially in the heat. Even occasional summer watering will kill it or shorten its life, which is only about 4 or 5 years anyway. But wow, what a gift to hummingbirds and other pollinators, not to mention anyone who loves a dramatic, fragrant garden. This one is worth the effort. Celestial Blue Sage, Salvia celestial blue, is another super fragrant, vibrantly colorful native hybrid that blooms in spring and well into summer, with purple and electric blue pinwheels of flowers on tall stems. It is a cross between Cleveland sage, Salvia clevelandii, blue sage, Salvia pacophylla, and purple sage, Salvia leucophylla, created by Bert Wilson of Las Palitas Nursery. Coyote mint, Monardella viosa, is a summer bloomer with pink or lavender pom-pom blooms on mid-sized stems and fragrant, minty, light green foliage. It spreads into a colorful ground cover, grows well in containers, and is popular with pollinators. And finally, winter bloomers into spring. Showy penstemon, Penstemon spectabilis, bloom profusely in almost electrically vibrant shades of violet infused with blue and pink. It is believed to be a host plant to more than a dozen butterflies and moths in their larval stage, and it starts blooming in the late winter when wildflowers are still trying to awake. Fast-growing, up to 4 feet tall, but can be short-lived with too much water. Brittle bush, Encelia farinosa, has sunny, yellow, daisy-like flowers on a shrub with leaves so silvery green they almost look white. Dramatic in the garden, blooms winter into spring. It can grow up to 5 feet tall and may lose many of its leaves in the summer, but occasional hot water irrigation will help retain its foliage. Butterflies love its flowers, especially in the winter when native nectar is scarce and birds feast on its seeds. Brittlebush thrives in dry conditions, according to CalScape, and is well suited for slopes and hillsides. And finally, Pacific Coast irises, Iris Pacific Coast, are very showy first sparks of color after a long drab winter, sending up frilly, breathtaking flowers in almost every imaginable color as early as February, says breeder Sussman, who sells a wide variety of these native irises at Matilaha Nursery. Native irises prefer shadier conditions than their cousins, the tall, bearded irises that like full sun. But over time, the plants will multiply so you can increase your holdings. Check out Sussman's website to drool over his selection and call ahead to see if your favorites are available. And that is it for this article, 13 Showstopping California Native Plants That Will Bring Riotous Color to Your Garden, written by Jeanette Marantos. It was published on June 2nd in the Los Angeles Times. Stay in Southern California with our next article, written by Max Morris and Luca Carmignani. It was published in the Los Angeles Times on June 2nd. And these guest contributors focus on California's proposed ban on plants near homes could be dangerously bad advice. One of the most striking patterns in the aftermath of many urban fires is how much unburned green vegetation remains amid the wreckage of burned neighborhoods. In some cases, a row of shrubs may be all that separates a surviving house from one that burned just a few feet away. As scientists who study how vegetation ignites and burns, we aren't surprised by these images. We recognize that well-maintained plants and trees can help protect homes from wind-blown embers and slow the spread of fire in some cases. So we are concerned about new wildfire protection regulations being developed by California that would prohibit almost all plants and other combustible materials within 5 feet of homes, an area known as Zone Zero. Wildfire safety guidelines have long encouraged homeowners to avoid having flammable materials next to their homes. But the state's plan for an ember-resistant zone, being expedited under an executive order from Governor Gavin Newsom, goes further by also prohibiting grass, shrubs, and many trees in that area. If that prohibition remains in the final regulation, it's likely to be met with public resistance. Getting those rules right also matters beyond California, because regulations that originate here often ripple outward to other fire-prone regions. Research into how vegetation can reduce fire risk is a relatively new area of study. However, the findings from plant flammability studies, as well as examination of sites where vegetation and homes survive large urban fires, highlight its importance. When surviving plants appear scorched after these fires, it is often on the side of the plant facing a nearby structure that burned. That suggests that wind-blown embers ignited houses first. The houses were then the fuel as the fire spread through the neighborhood. We saw this repeatedly in the Los Angeles area after wildfires destroyed thousands of homes in January. The pattern suggests a need to focus on the many factors that can influence home losses. Several guides are available that explain steps homeowners can take to help protect houses, particularly from wind-blown embers, known as home hardening. Some examples include installing rain gutter covers to keep dead leaves from accumulating, avoiding flammable siding, and ensuring that vents have screens to prevent embers from getting into the attic or crawl space. However, guidance related to landscaping plants varies greatly, and some of it is bad advice. For example, some fire-safe plant lists contain species that are drought-tolerant but not necessarily fire-resistant. When it comes to keeping plants from becoming fuel for fires, what matters more than species selection is how well vegetation is maintained and whether it's properly watered. Location matters too. Dry, unmanaged plants under windows or near fences may ignite rapidly and make it more likely that the house itself will catch fire. When well-watered, living plant material is heated by a nearby energy source, such as a fire, the moisture inside must be driven off before it can ignite. That evaporation cools the surrounding area and lowers the plant's flammability. In many cases, high moisture keeps a plant from igniting. We've seen this in some of our experimental work and in other studies that test the flammability of ornamental landscaping. With enough heat, dried leaves and stems can break down and release volatile gases. At that point, a nearby spark or flame can ignite these gases and set the plant on fire. Even when the plant does burn, however, its moisture content can limit other aspects of flammability, such as how hot it burns. Green, well-maintained plants can slow the spread of a fire by serving as heat sinks, absorbing energy and even blocking embers. This apparent protective role has been observed in both Australia and California studies of home losses. How often vegetation buffers homes from igniting during urban conflagrations is still unclear, but this capacity has implications for regulations. Many of the latest Zone Zero recommendations, such as prohibiting mulch and attached fences made of materials that can burn, stem from large-scale tests conducted by the National Institute of Standards and Technology and the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety. These features can be systematically analyzed. But vegetation is far harder to model. The state's proposed Zone Zero regulations oversimplify complex conditions in real neighborhoods and go beyond what is currently known from scientific research regarding plant flammability. Vegetation is not monolithic. A mature, well-pruned shrub or tree with a high crown may pose little risk of burning and can even reduce exposure to fires by blocking wind and heat and intercepting embers. Aspen trees, for example, have been recommended to reduce fire risk near structures or other high-value assets. As California and other states develop new wildfire regulations, they need to recognize the protective role that well-managed plants can play, along with many other benefits of urban vegetation. We believe the California proposal's current emphasis on highly prescriptive vegetation removal instead of on maintenance is overly simplistic. Without complementary requirements for hardening the homes themselves, widespread clearing of landscaping immediately around homes could do little to reduce risk and could even aggravate the danger. Max Morris is a Cooperative Extension wildfire specialist and an adjunct professor of environmental science at UC Santa Barbara. Luca Carmignani is an assistant professor of mechanical engineering at San Diego State University. This article was produced in partnership with The Conversation and was published in the Los Angeles Times on June 2nd under the title California's Proposed Ban on Plants Near Homes Could Be Dangerously Bad Advice. I turn next to an article by Stephen Anderton, published in the Times of London on April 9th. I've had the same garden for 20 years. Here are the top 6 things I've learned. They say it takes 15 years to make a garden, and we've been here 19. It feels rather unnerving to have a garden that's now so comfortably established when I've spent half my career restoring abandoned historic ones. Leaving drought-stricken North Essex for the Black Mountains of Monmouthshire may have seemed a leap of faith at the time, but it was a great move. Wet Wales? Nonsense, not East Wales. Only an hour from the Severn. Decent soil, warm evenings, full southern light. It's great even at 900 feet, even if sometimes it blows a gale. For the first time this summer, I will be opening up my garden to visitors as part of the National Garden Scheme. It has made me wonder, what advice can I share? Here are some of the lessons I've learned in the years spent creating this space. 1. Let some plants run wild. When times are quiet, especially in winter and spring, it's good to let some easy care plants run wild. Snowdrops, regularly divided, create no work. The short daff jetfire never flops, and it's everywhere throughout my flower garden. Self-seeding forget-me-nots, foxgloves, and opium poppies, annuals and biennials, make temporary washes of color that can be ripped out afterwards. You just have to learn to recognize the seedlings. 2. You can't have too much perfume. Some time ago, I planted an area of wild shrubberies in my garden, but then I thought, why not make everything fragranced? Kick off with Eleognis Quicksilver in May, seg into half a dozen different kinds of mock orange through June, then have white rugosa trees flowering on, and all of the above set in spring and autumn bulb grass. Then there are honeysuckles for spring and autumn scent. A plant with perfume gets so many more marks in my book. 3. Keep your choice of pots simple. I've tried so many kinds of pots in my garden, and in the end I come back to oak half barrels and palest terracotta. The more invisible, the better. If you want lots of pots, they should have something in common with each other and with the house. Repetition is a good thing in a garden. It avoids fussiness. Wooden barrels suit this wooded country just as red terracotta would suit a red brick house. Unless the pot is a classical gem, it's the plants that are meant to be the stars. 4. Focus on one job at a time. It's all too easy to spread your efforts thinly across a whole garden when you're working on it, but often the result is that nowhere looks quite as good as you want it to. Instead, you need to create some easy areas that are quick to care for, with others that may cost work but pay real dividends. Don't plant perennials everywhere, for example. I wanted to have one really good flower garden beside the house with January to December interest, densely planted. I knew it would be lots of work, but that the rewards would show big time. It's packed, which means I have to thin it ruthlessly as plants get bigger so that it remains full but healthy. It's hard work, but so rewarding. 5. Choose the right plant for the right place. This should be everyone's rule. Here I must accommodate the occasional gales we experience. Finding plants that can not only stand it, but don't look as if they are struggling. In other words, those plants that remain bolt upright in windy weather, like mulleins, or easily spring back, like miscanthus, as well as evergreens such as box, pittosporum, and Japanese privet, which can be clipped to hump their backs against the wind. Scots roses, Rosa spinosissima, are perfect. Cannas, a waste of time, and Hedychiums, surprisingly good. It's also worth considering what kind of soil you have. The red sandstone soil in my garden is quite sandy, and in a densely planted garden, drought is my problem rather than drowning. That means perennials such as thirsty phlox and anaphylus must be kept regularly refreshed and divided, but bulbs that like to bake, such as nerines, amarenes, and sternbergia, simply love it. 6. Plant a tree, even in small gardens. Even the smallest garden deserves a small tree. Trees extend the habitat of a garden, vertically and temporally, never mind what bugs and fungi and birds and mammals they support. They offer riches. For us aesthetes, they also offer changing light and shade, while the long clean lines from their trunk contrast with perennial borders and open space. I'm lucky enough to have an old oak woodland, formerly charcoal coppice, that was last clearly felled 100 years ago. We hand weed it now and then, of Christmas trees and hollies, brambles and ivy, and clear away fallen trees so its extraordinary carpet of moss and trunk's geometry can speak. To let the wood be itself, we resist adding any garden plants, and the result is rare and wonderful. Sometimes, quiet and simple is all anyone needs. Stephen Anderton's garden at New Inn Farm in Gwent will be opened by arrangement from July 1 to September 30th. Tickets include a garden tour, tea, and cake. Adults £20, children free. For more details, see ngs.org.uk. and an article by Stephen Anderton published on April 9th in the Times of London, I've had the same garden for 20 years. Here are the top 6 things I've learned. We close this week with another article focusing on an idiosyncratic but valued garden. This article by Tom Jeffries was published May 29th in the Financial Times of London, Growth Potential, the Small North London Garden with Big Eco-Ambitions. From tarmacked plot to lush green sanctuary, the somewhat secret Omved Gardens is relaunching as the UK's first center for food, ecology, and creativity. It's both local community hub and agitator for global change. The traffic-laden Archway Road in North London is not where you'd expect to find one of the UK's most fascinating gardens. But venture down a side alley off Highgate High Street, and you'll find a lush, curvaceous tangle where the air is heady from banks of rosemary and lavender, and sinuous paths skirt a pond overhung by willow and birch. The somewhat secret spot is Omved Gardens, first opened in 2017 by Karen Leeson. Having been involved in educational and environmental initiatives, as well as natural childbirth provision in India, she chose the name Omved, O-M, capital V-E-D, from 2 Sanskrit words relating to wisdom and the universe. When Leeson bought the site, it was a garden center. Its transformation involved digging up large areas of tarmac and concrete to create not only a beautiful retreat, but also a community hub and event space. This month, the initiative, a community interest company, CIC, is being relaunched as the UK's first center for food ecology and creativity. The project did not start with this as a predefined vision. Through conversations between Leeson and landscape architect Paul Gezervitz, winner of 2 medals for his work at the RHS Chelsea Flower Show, the idea emerged to focus on habitats. This has been the foundation of all that we do, says Leeson. In 2017, the first Omved event was a dinner for the UN's World Food Programme to discuss ways that a small North London garden could contribute to global efforts toward greater food security. Every June, the garden plays host to the Chef's Manifesto, another UN initiative which sets out to harness the power of the culinary industry to create fairer and more sustainable food systems. Omved may be forging its own path, but it is among a number of innovative urban ecological initiatives reconnecting people in imaginative ways with the food we grow and eat. Take Amy Franceschini's Victory Garden in San Francisco, begun in 2007, which has grown into a city-supported network of urban farmers. Or artist Annie Lord's The Neighboring Orchard in Edinburgh, commissioned by Art Walks Projects, which has planted over 160 apple trees in gardens along the coast. Omved aims to inspire conversations around food security and the need for major systemic change. It is a place to think. At the heart of this is the planting, says Leeson. People are so strict with their gardens about how they should look and what they should be achieving with them, she says. But I don't want to enter a garden and feel like I'm failing to live up to an ideal. I want to feel nourished and comforted and uplifted. I find that much more inspirational. Gezervitz has been a driving force. A landscape architect has to listen to the natural world, to the site, to its location, and then respond, he says. If you push against nature, it pushes back harder. He has employed the Miyawaki technique, a strategy developed by the late Japanese botanist Akira Miyawaki, that clusters different native trees very close together to encourage the rapid generation of biodiverse mini-forests. The 2-acre site is flourishing, influenced by permaculture principles. Edibles and ornamentals jostle along merrily together. Sweet peas and calendula grow up alongside squash and corn, while nasturtiums spill from circular raised beds. Omved has been updated with a cluster of new buildings. An old greenhouse that reached the end of its life has had its wooden frames converted into exhibition plinths and platforms. In its place comes a new double-height greenhouse built on passive design principles. It joins three further additions: a new seed library, a multi-purpose barn to host events, and a new kitchen with accessible green roof for an expanded program of activities. All were designed by Smerin Architects, known for its minimalist aesthetic and innovative use of natural materials. The new spaces will enable a year-round program of events. This June, there will be workshops on low-cost food growing and healthy, affordable cooking. The seed storage and research will be shared with school groups and other local communities. OMVET is also working with local green spaces, such as Highgate Cemetery, to encourage more pollinator-friendly approaches to planting and management. OMVET's approach to cultural programming mirrors that of its planting, open-minded and generous. For the past year, Vivian Shadinsky has been artist-in-residence, immersing herself in the life of the gardens. Inspired by conversations with scientists and researchers, the London-based environmental artist and educator, known for her Japanese Sumi-A monochrome ink painting, has focused on the world-changing potential of beans. It's a subject that relates to OMVET's ongoing work with Chef's Manifesto, which is campaigning to double global consumption of beans, as well as peas, lentils, and other pulses by 2028. Beans are nutrient-dense and easy to store, as well as easy to grow. They are drought-resilient and fix nitrogen in the soil, a superfood for the age of climate change. In conversation with institutions such as Kew Gardens and the Millennium Seed Bank in Wakehurst, Shadinsky has worked with OMVET's gardeners to grow beans on-site and test the positive impact they can have on soil health. The result is a suite of new artworks, which will be on view this summer. I hope that people will leave with the sense that something small can carry a lot of weight, says Shadinsky. She is talking about beans. She could just as well be talking about this green and dynamic corner of North London. OMVET Gardens, oneword.com is the website. OMVET Gardens reopens to the public on May 31st. This article by Tom Jeffries was published on May 29th in the Financial Times of London. Growth potential, the small North London garden with big eco ambitions. And that wraps up episode 297 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening program produced for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. Please send comments to www.lars.org or email us at oneword laradioreading@gmail.com. Give us suggestions of gardens or stories to follow, your thoughts on a favorite story you heard, or what you think about the broadcast itself. Gardens are not just plant, soil, and irrigation. They speak to us of the world around us, even as we try to create order and structure. They connect us to our landscape and to the cycles of nature. They teach us patience, stewardship, and fortitude. They offer possibilities of beauty and of persistence, sometimes even of transcendence. And they open our senses to both the heart and the soul, to being alive, to being connected with other gardens, other gardeners, and other times. Whether in a container or in pots on a balcony in the city, in a defined, dedicated garden area, planted around a suburban house or in an urban courtyard, or in spaces surrounded by trees, landscape, and open sky, gardens are precious indeed, no matter where they are. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host. Thanks for joining us. Until the next time.